David Hare has long been one of Britain's best-known screenwriters and dramatists. He's the author of more than 30 acclaimed plays that have appeared on Broadway, in the West End, and at the National Theatre. He wrote the screenplays for the hugely successful films The Hours, Plenty, and The Reader. Most recently, his play Skylight won the 2015 Tony Award for Best Revival on Broadway. His new work is a memoir. It is entitled The Blue Touch Paper, and it is a great pleasure to welcome David Hare to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
What brought you to the project of wanting to write memoir and to tell about some of your experiences in this business?
Well, I'm 68 years old, and because my parents made me feel when I was young, I was brought up in the 1950s and 60s, because I'd just missed the Second World War, I'd always assumed that I'd missed the main event, and therefore I felt that I'd led a life of absolutely no interest and lived in uninteresting times. But then when I wrote a play about my education as a teenager, and I had to explain to teenage actors today what Britain was like in the 1950s, they were absolutely amazed and said, my God, this sounds more like Britain in Victorian times. It's so far away. And I realized that if I didn't write about it, nobody was going to write about it. So I wanted to capture a period that has gone so completely.
At what point did you know that your path would eventually bring you to theater?
Well, it was really not what I wanted to do. I went to university, and when I came down from university, I would love to have gone into movies, but there was no British film industry. It was in one of its characteristically enfeebled periods. And really, I only went into the theater to use it for political ends. I started a traveling theater company to go to places where theater's not usually seen or heard, in order to talk to a new audience, create a new audience in prisons and in army camps and in village halls and on floors and in new universities, in students' unions and anywhere where theatre wasn't usually done, to try and dramatize what we thought was the dire state of our country at that time in the late 1960s, early 70s. And so it was really a political urge that got me into theatre as a director. And it was only later that, first of all, I became a playwright, pretty much by chance. And then I sort of developed a fascination with the form itself, which has meant that I've been a playwright for 45 years.
The company you spoke of a moment ago, it's the Portable Theater Company. And
that's right.
You would go around the country, When you write about this, you talk of the opportunity that you had to go in, do your thing, leave, go on to the next place. That it was, as the title suggests, very portable, and it gave you many, many opportunities, and I assume a great learning opportunity.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I learned was, because we were working the lights and we were sticking up the sound system and we were probably stage managing, and on occasions if things got really bad and somebody was missing, I'd even have to act. I learned what it's like to sit through a play and to sit through plays that I wrote for it, and my experience of that has never left me. I know how easily an audience can be lost and distracted, and I've sat through some pretty excruciating evenings in which my plays have failed in front of, numbers of people, and you feel that moment when the audience's attention wanders and you haven't entertained or interested them. And I think that was a fantastic training. The fact that I had to sit through so many of my own bad plays at the beginning, I think was fantastically good for me to begin to write better plays,
When do you know the difference between a bad play and a good play in your own personal work? I mean, is it the outside forces of commercial success, or is it your own internal knowing what's good?
I think it's at the first preview, and nothing ever really changes. I mean, what I mean is the first time you put a play before an audience, you can feel a quality of concentration in the audience. If you're sitting among them, and I always sit right in the middle at the first preview, because I want to know whether they're responding. Because in my work, at least, the play's kind of speculation, meaning that it comes out of a feeling where I feel something very strongly. This is the way I see the world. And you propose, look, this is how things seem to me. And you say to the audience, does anybody here recognize this? Does anyone here know what I'm talking about? And when you write a successful play, you immediately feel the answer come back, yes. You know, you can feel the audience go, I know what you're talking about. And to hear it articulated is completely wonderful, and I recognize it. And that goes on around you in the audience. And when you write a play that's going to be a flop, you know that the audience is thinking, well, he may feel this, but we don't feel it. It doesn't seem so important to us. And the plays I've been very passionate about and believed in, which have not caught on, and there are plays which I've had exactly the same feelings about, and they have caught on, and you never know which way it's going to go.
Your first breakout success was Slag. Did you know then?
Not at all. Not till, well, look, at the beginning I wrote comedy, and comedy is an absolutely brutal form of education for a writer because, frankly, if they laugh, it works. If they don't laugh, it isn't working. It's as simple as that. And so my first three plays were comedies, and, you know, I knew whether they were working according to whether people were laughing or not. It's delightfully simple with comedy. But no, that it was exhilarating with Slag to discover that I could write a full-length play. It was in front of the audience, and they were all roaring with laughter and just having a wonderful time. And I can remember to this day the exhilaration of coming out of the first performance and going, wow, I can do something here.
Are you still interested in a form of satire, in a form of parody, in a form of looking at situations in a different way?
Much less than I used to be. I suppose that when you're young, satire is the form, because basically saying no to everything is what a satirist does. You know, the satirist points out the faults in everything, and we all laugh together at the faults. And that kind of thing is exhilarating, and it's great fun when you're young. But as you go on, you want to start building things in which you do believe, rather than just knocking things in which you don't believe. And so once towards the end of maybe the end of the 1980s, when my country took a direction of which I did not approve, in other words, we abandoned our belief in the common good, and we had governments which instead entirely backed entrepreneurs and private industry and, you know, let go public services, let go the National Health Service, wound down everything that made my country a place of common values and instead just emphasized individual values. Once that, then I had a very strong feeling that I wanted to start writing about the people who I believed were bandaging society's wounds. And by that, I mean the teachers, the nurses, the doctors, the good people who still dedicate themselves to, and in my best known plays, maybe Racing Demon, which is about the Church of England, where vicars are, you know, working on behalf of their community, or Skylight, where the teachers teaching in the worst kind of schools in the East End. These are the people that I wanted to write about more and more, because to hold on to values of the common good when the entire culture is screaming at you that you're stupid for still believing in it, I think these people are wonderful people to write about.
I most recently saw your work at Skylight when the revival was on Broadway, and it's an amazing piece of work. I'm curious as to when do you know it's right for a revival, and especially a work like that that is probably forever vibrant?
I think it's mainly to do with the fact that it was originally played by Michael Gambon and Lear Williams. And Michael Gambon is, you know, regarded in England as probably one of the greatest stage actors of his generation. And so whenever people wanted to revive that play, I said, sure, if you tell me who's going to play the part of the man. And they'd always say to me, well, we've got so-and-so to play the woman. And I'd say, yeah, I know you can get so-and-so to play the woman, but please tell me who's going to play the man and be able to compete with the memory of Michael Gambon. And that actor turned out to be Bill Nye. And the minute Bill wanted to do it, then when Kerry Mulligan said she wanted to do it, then I said, okay, we can now have a revival that is going to stand comparison with the memory of the original production. And that's what happened. And the play, everybody said to me, oh, you seem to have rewritten Skylight, and you can't have written speeches 20 years ago that seem as timely as they do tonight. And I would say, I've not changed a word. What has changed is you and the situation and the context in which the play has seen. But I didn't rewrite a word of it.
Did you change, too, in the sense of seeing it with the new cast, that you saw it in a new way?
I don't think so. I think that, as I say, for me, maybe the emphases of the play seemed a little bit different, but I think that's because the production was different. And when I first wrote the play, everybody said, well, it's a brilliant first act, and then, of course, the second act can't quite keep up to it. But certainly on Broadway, and I think in the West End as well, when Carey Mulligan let go those, you know, tirades in the second act on behalf of people who are still trying to do good in society, then the sort of rounds of applause and cheers that came from the audience meant that those speeches perhaps had a resonance that they didn't have so much 20 years ago.
Tell me about the Blue Room and being ready for something that just becomes sort of larger than life.
Well, I don't think any of us prepared for the Blue Room. I mean, the Blue Room was an adaptation I did of Schnitzler's La Ronde, which I reset in the present day.
Right.
And Nicole Kidman, you know, said she wanted to act in it. And, you know, I said that was a jolly good idea and I'd love to see her on stage. And at some point, you know, during the dress rehearsal of the play, Nicole Kidman quite casually said to the director, Sam Mendes, maybe if I took my clothes off at this point, that would be appropriate. And Sam said, yeah, I never thought of that. That seems a good idea. It seems the right place for it. That seems natural. She took her clothes off. And from that point on, the world went absolutely insane to a point where we ended up on the cover of Newsweek magazine and, you know, people were scalping tickets at $1,000 a night. You know, Sam Mendes and Nicole and I were sort of living in the center of this storm that was sweeping through our lives. But I think it was probably a phenomenon of publicity rather than a phenomenon of art. And it's sad because at the center of it all was, you know, a very, very good stage performance by Nicole Kidman, who's a terrific stage actress. And also at the center of it was my little play, which maybe got overlooked in the rush, you know.
So do you have a desire to look at that play in a different way at some point?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see a revival of it so that people could actually see what the play was. But, you know, they were strange times, and you can't prepare for that sort of thing when you have thousands of people cheering in the streets outside a theater. Until you've been at the center of one of those media storms, there's nothing you can do except, you know, let it pass through your life and hope for some quiet at the end of it, you know.
Do you still feel you're...
I can't say it's got a lot to, it hasn't got a lot to do with playwriting.
Well... So let's talk about the playwriting as we wrap up. Are you at a point where you feel that you're writing some of your best work?
Oh, yeah. But but come on, I'm delusional like all playwrights. I always feel that. You know, all playwrights have to feel that. If you don't feel that. I mean, I certainly felt when I wrote Stuff Happens, which was at the turn of the century, just after the invasion of Iraq, and I wrote about the diplomatic process, I did feel... This was a play that was absolutely bang on the button and as good as anything that I'd ever written. And the play that I've written recently, which is a play about the opening of the Glyndebourne Opera House and how it came about that a mad English eccentric in Sussex founded what is now the most famous opera house in Britain with the help of some German refugees who were running away from Hitler, of whom that eccentric had never even heard before he employed them. And how it was really chance that we ended up with this great opera house. I think that's, you know, I know that's one of the best plays I've ever written. And so, yeah, I don't feel any diminution of powers as the years go by, no.
Well, the memoir is delightful. It is The Blue Touch Paper, a memoir. It is published by Norton. David Harrer, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Well, a great pleasure for me, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Blue Touch Paper, a memoir, published by Norton, by David Harrer. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.